You all hear me? Okay, great. Well, I'm delighted that each of you are here today to celebrate the special Year of the Horse, which I know has special meaning. It's a strong year, a swift year, a fast year, a powerful year for us all. So I remember just about a year and a half ago, I was doing my morning run, and Michael gave me a call, and he asked, Grace, what do you think about my teaching in China this summer? And I thought back to my teaching at Fudan, which I did a couple of summers several years ago through an MIT joint venture, which I adored. I adored my time teaching in China. And so I pretty quickly told Michael that he should just do it. So several months ago in the summer when he was in Beijing, we were corresponding, he's advising one of my clients in their M&A, he's doing M&A advisor for a client, and he mentioned that he would be interested in sharing some of his thoughts about his experiences in China with people here. So this is how this came to be. And this past week, I had the opportunity to interview the three of you, and it was been covered in WRL Local Tech Wire. So I encourage you to go to WRL Tech Wire to read some things that we may not necessarily cover today, but interesting stories that my three guests. So I think you've seen in the meeting notice for this event their bios. So I thought instead of just regurgitating their wonderful accomplishments, I'd share a little story about how I met each of them. So first, Yensheng, it's been almost a decade since we met, and I was chairing a CEB conference, and a mutual friend of ours at IBM suggested that we meet. So Yensheng came up to me and said, oh, would you like to have coffee? I said, sure. So I remember at that coffee, Yensheng left quite an impression. She was so bold, so confident, so assertive, and I thought, wow, what an amazing Chinese woman. She made quite the mark on the wine. And then I went off and did my own thing. And some of you may know I had a pretty horrific cycling accident when I turned 40. And it really kind of set me into an unusual mode of not being able to do my usual thing in the triangle. So I was resting. I was forced to rest for several months. And one day when I was resting, I got a phone call. And I heard this woman's voice talking to my answer machine. It was Yensheng. And she was saying, oh, Grace, I was wondering if you could help with some outreach. We are having the 12 Women Band of Beijing come and perform at UNC Memorial Hall to raise money for the Red Cross and Katrina victims. And so I can barely walk, but I covered the phone and picked it up and said, hi, Yensheng. Of course, I'd love to help, but I can barely walk. So what happened was I ended up buying some tickets for my family and for some clients. And Yensheng came to my side during my recovery. And she actually came and picked me up. I was not yet able to drive. And she took my parents and myself to UNC for that performance. And since then, we became fast friends. And very sadly, Yensheng lost her sister to breast cancer shortly before that. So we became adopted sisters, or Chinese sisters, because we both live in carrying a farm with each other. So that was the start of our friendship almost a decade ago. And then during that time, she also asked me if I could help her with starting this nonprofit, which I quickly said yes. So that's a little bit about our story. And I must say that Yensheng made a really big impression on me. She represents to me courage, determination, selflessness, and boldness that I really don't know in anyone else. So thank you, Yensheng. You've taught me so much about China, about the Chinese. And for some of you, you know, when I had my cycling accident and some of the head injury, the brain injury I had, that's with my memory. So I was harking back to my roots. When I was born, my first words were in Chinese. And that made me realize that I wanted, after my recovery, to go back to China and reaffirm my roots. Again, thank you, Yensheng. So, Yensheng, as you probably read in her bio, she attended Peking University, which, as you know, is one of the most elite schools in China, where she studied her undergraduate and graduate studies in electrical engineering and environmental science. And then she marched to Tiananmen Square. And then she came here, and you know, you guys know how hard it is to come here from China to pursue graduate studies. And she got her PhD at NC State, and then her MBA from Duke, and she's had a great career both in the sciences and in business. Most recently, she spent, I believe, over a decade with IBM, where she had various roles on the business development sales, and she reported directly to the SVP of IBM Research, the Watson Lab. So she's had quite a variety of interesting experiences. Okay, so next, Michael. So, I don't know if you know how long I've known you, but it's been a while. It's been about 7 years, I think. So, I met Michael because a mutual friend of ours, Randy, invited us to a basketball game. And I was very excited because Randy has amazing seats. But that was part of the interest of the evening. But it began a friendship with Michael. And I appreciate that because I respect Michael a great deal, both professionally and personally. And Michael has served in various roles in the government. He has served in the Bush Senior Administration, and recently he has an appointment from Governor McCrory to serve, I have to make sure I get this right, the Board of Trustees of the Teachers and State Employees Retirement System. And I know since we have both taught at UNC, how well-respected he is at the school. He teaches one of the most oversubscribed courses in corporate governance, which he takes very seriously. I know how much work it is to be a professor at UNC, having kind of been there. And I also respect his decades of investment banking experience and his expertise in M&A advisory, and so much so that we're partnering, and he's helping some of my clients figuring out their exits when they want to sell their companies, or they want to take money out of companies that they started. So, that's wonderful. So next, Paul, too. So he's my newest friend, but now that I got a chance to interview you for WRL last week, I feel like we're almost related.
Yeah.
So we have so much in common, I think partly from our family background. And then I think one of the through lines that we share is that I think we both gained from our fathers, our family, the importance of serving the community and giving back. And then I didn't realize also professionally, we've both been involved with technology companies that actually sold to competitors. I just found that out last week. So that's interesting. And then, but where we diverge is that Paul did do the practical thing, and he did study engineering. I did not, but I went to an engineering school. And he worked for the prestigious Bell Labs, where only my smartest friends at MIT worked for. So from Bell Labs, he forged new paths for them in other countries, so he's had a very global career. And then he also, after that, decided to go off and start his own company. And from there, I have great respect for you, Paul, that you've decided to give back from the money that you made and start your own foundation. And then also, you'll talk a little bit more about starting Junior Achievement China. So when I interviewed him for WRL, he said that China's greatest export is not manufacturing, it's Junior Achievement China. Oh, sorry. So I think you'll enjoy getting a chance to know him. So what I've done is I prepared some questions to ask the panelists, and then after we complete a series of questions, and actually some of the questions I have are ones that you've already submitted to me, so I interweave a few of your questions already, the questions that I plan to ask, and then we'll open up to Q&A to the audience. Okay, great. Well, first let me understand a little bit, and maybe help the panelists also, who's here in the audience. By show of hands, who here was born in China? Okay, so a good percentage of you. Okay, so if you weren't born in China, are you currently doing business in China? Okay, so if you were born in China, let's keep those hands raised. And those who are born in China and those not born in China but are doing business in China, raise your hand. Okay. Okay, who here maybe is not currently doing business in China but would like to in the coming years? And who here is a student? Or I know there's some people here who are with universities here. Could you show your hand? Okay, great. Okay. Well, thank you very much for helping me understand the composition of our audience. So my first question I'd like to ask Paul is, what is your advice for North Carolina or U.S. companies who are looking to enter China? And then I'm also going to ask you about Chinese companies wanting to enter North Carolina. If you could share some of your thoughts on that.
That's pretty challenging question. One, I really want to encourage the audience. And so I'm going to quote Dr. Henry Kissinger.
Okay.
And on August 8th, 2008, I was invited to attend a meeting on the 96th floor of the International Financial Center in Shanghai, sponsored by American Express. And Dr. Henry Kissinger was invited, and also Mr. John Thornton, and who retired from Goldman Sachs, and with the intent to advise the leaders of China to understand America. And he taught in Tsinghua University. And President-elect Obama was just elected on probably November. Already, I think November the 2nd. And so Dr. Henry Kissinger and said that point one, he said the future belongs to China and America. And second point, he said forget about Europe, because Europe continues to struggle whether they are a member nation or state nation and so on. So people asked Dr. Henry Kissinger, as President-elect Obama has asked you for advice. He said, sooner or later he's going to ask me. So I took his answer, statement very seriously. I truly believe that the China and America will become the leaders of this global market. So therefore, I really want to encourage you to consider whatever you do, stay in the intersection between China and America. And so feel strong about it and give commitment to that. My advice to people who want to go to China, and I would say that number one, be yourself. You have to have a very strong identity, and know your strengths, know what you're looking for, and know your culture background, and understand the other side. I think to understand China first, and have a game plan, and execute the plan. And don't consider that somehow you move to China, you hand your knowledge, you know how everything at the door. So also that you landed in China, you become a very ignorant person. And I've seen many foreigners going to China, and they ask very naive questions. And I think you should go to China fully confident in yourself, knowing that you're strong and healthy, and most importantly, very progressive. Now, progressive doesn't mean that you're on the left side. Progressive meaning that you're very open-minded, and you want to go there to learn. If you have to eat a fish, an eye of a fish, and eat an eye of fish. So try some difference. You cannot go there as American, and this is wrong, and this is right, and so on. So I think be strong, be healthy, but most importantly, open-minded. And in culture, there is no right or wrong. It's just a different way of living. So if you can carry Americanness into China, likewise, you can learn the Chineseness in America. So know yourself. And secondly, things not to do. And when you go to China, please don't represent America. You represent Michael Jacobs. So don't go there and talk like American. And don't treat the Chinese on the other side, that young lady that young man doesn't represent China. So, in other words, treat the other side as individual. Understand that individual. Present yourself as individual. And so don't represent America, nor do treat the other side as Chinese. So be yourself, be confident, and believe in the future is between China and America. And execute a plan, and don't compromise. And I think that will be my advice to the audience.
Okay, great. Thank you, Paul. So, Yansheng, I've witnessed firsthand the rapid rise of MBAs and EMBAs programs in China, having taught there several years ago, and even between, I think it was 2007, 2008 were the summers that I taught, even in between those 2 years, the enrollment at Fudan's program, it was skyrocketed. So many students wanting to learn about business, and then so many multinationals needing to hire people from China that it just can't quite keep up. So we see now at UNC and at Duke, and it both investing in programs and even campuses in China. Could you comment on the landscape of the ability for local talent to be hired in China, both if you could comment on entrepreneurial companies and larger corporations?
Absolutely. Somebody hear me?
Yes.
Oh, got it. So, yes. So, I can certainly comment on the talent. So, if you are talking about, we are talking about doing business in China, and you have
two workers, is it sound okay?
Sound okay? I'm not doing that. Can you hear me? Oh, this is better. Technology. So, you have to look at any business, whether you're doing business in China or you're doing business here, and just say American companies go to China and you're doing business there, you'll have two things I would look at it. One, you are either selling products in China, so you go to sell product in China, or you're producing products probably from China, in China, and selling somewhere else. On both sides, if you look at it, you have to develop a local talent. There's no way you can leverage the local talent, whether you're selling to the consumers there, or you're producing, leveraging the local talent and selling it here. So, and to the question is that looking at the talent itself, China has a big, huge talent pool. So how you leverage leverage the strength. So if you can look at it, the talent pool, how you can help train or leverage the existing talent itself for your business. That's the way I see the business should approach, right? So we will talk about the, oh, China, we are going to open business in China, but we cannot find the talent. I have to say, among the 1.3 billion people, there's got to be a way to find the talent. That's the last thing you would tell anybody, say, I can't find talent. I think it's just an excuse in many ways, and sorry to be blunt, the thing maybe you need to think about it, what's in it for you to begin with. And to have a business, viable business, we got to figure out how to make money, right? No matter where it is. And so that is where, to your point, that like a Duke, UNC here, all recognize the importance of education in China. They open up campuses there, like Kunshan just opened, very successful. Now, if you look back at the US, 100 years ago, even 50 years ago, just taking Duke as an example, in the early 1900s, it's not even here. So there's no name, but now it has a reputation and really have a viable education there. So I can see 50 years from now on, in China, you will see the first class education in business in China as well, which will produce the right talent for that region. And you cannot depend on the, like always people educated here and going back. So I can see a lot of interest from local talent there in Beijing or Shanghai, big place. Many of the young people, they are not aspired coming here, more and more so. Still, we provide a first-class education here. But more and more, you will see local talent are produced there. Innovation started to get there, but there is a big distance right now.
Okay, thank you, Yanqing. So my next question is, and this is Yanqing and maybe Paul or Michael, you can always chime in too. What are some of the toughest cultural challenges for Chinese who are coming to the U.S.? And if you want to share maybe some of any of your stories.
You want to? I can start. Actually, two things, maybe. One, I call it, or we call it a pool culture in China. I would say the business, I'm talking about doing business, Chinese doing business coming to the U.S., right? So if you look at the Chinese culture, by the way, it's very dependent on Wenqi. You build a business, once you build it up, you're pretty safe for a while because you feel comfortable in that pool. So you jump in a pool, you can swim in that pool. But in the U.S., it's not so. So that's a challenge for many Chinese business people coming here because they couldn't, there isn't a pool you can swim in just right from the gate or depending on your relationship also. So that's one thing. So the culture differences. And the other thing I would say is the government relationship. I think it's so pivotal in doing business in China and because that's a necessity. You have to have it. So once you have it, the barrier of entry to be your competition is very high. So you don't have so much of a competition like here. The entry, the barrier of entry of any business is actually low. You do it, then you figure out how to deal with the government. So get things done is number one. So that's the barrier of entry in the U.S. is very low. And you can establish, anybody can open up a business, but how to be successful, you have so you start with the people. That's the culture challenges for both sides.
Can you rephrase the refresh?
Yeah, sure. So I
have a scared of mine, so I gotta.
So the question is, what are some of the challenges for people from China coming here to do business? Or vice versa.
I think that I'd like to contribute tonight that there's two words that we need to help us to look at this issue. One, the word culture. Culture is a word to describe how one conduct, how we live, how we eat, and I love fish heads. I don't think you dare to eat fish heads. Mm-hmm. And there's no right and wrong about culture. So culture is a local thing. But the second word called civilization. A civilization can be measured, can learn, and we can compare. So I will say, when you go to China or vice versa, come here, and I'd like everybody to feel comfortable about your own culture, because culture is local. At the same time, when we come to America, there is a gap between civilization and so there's a universal value in that civilization. So I think everyone can learn the other side. And so I encourage Chinese students or business people, when you come to America, you need to learn the American civilization. For instance, go to Super Bowl. it was a boring game to me. You have to understand those bunch of idiots, they hit each other so hard. And they spent so much money on it, and what's wrong with those guys? So there's a conversation that you can carry with your friends. Civilization, another thing is a certain joke that you joke around. It's a civilization in the plus some culture context. So you have to learn how to get around. You have to learn how to open door networking and be a bridge. So I encourage each one of us, we need to learn civilization. And so how do you eat? I mean, what we eat is a culture issue, but how we conduct ourselves, etiquette, right? So when the Chinese toast you, serve you tea, and when they put the cover of the tea on top of the teacup, means that I don't like you, it's time for you to leave. So I think each one of us can learn civilization. And how do we use fork? And how do we use knife? How do we use chopsticks? Right? So I want to make sure that coming to America is an exciting experience. So don't feel a sense of inferiority. Likewise, when you go to China, don't have a sense of the other side. So I think we can learn from each other. And so be healthy, be strong, and be open-minded, and maintain that self-respect and engage. Because the future belongs to you and me. You, America, me, China. And I think with that attitude when you come here, and it's going to be fun. I lost a dinner to this friend of mine whom I met in China. You know, he gave me a stroke on the back night. Man, I lost it so bad. So that's a civilization I learned. And I learned, I say, when I play with him next time, man, I better be careful. So treaty experience coming over is fun. And don't feel the draft going to China. That's where the future is. So I hope that I can show you some perspective here.
Thank you, Paul. So my next set of questions is centered on education, and I'm going to start with Michael. So as I've noted, Michael taught at UNC Human Plasma for many years, and now you've taught in China. So I'm interested if you can share with our audience today how you compare your students in China with those that you have here in the state at UNC.
That's an interesting question. Before I left to go to China, I talked to a number of academics who had taught in China. UNC has got a program over in China, so I talked to several of the faculty members there, and I heard the same thing from everybody that I talked to, and that is that the Chinese students learn differently than the American students. And I was told, don't go into a classroom and expect Chinese students to raise their hand and participate. They're going to take notes, they're going to keep their heads down, they're going to study hard, and they'll do well on tests. And I heard this repeatedly, and that created a problem for me because I don't know how to teach that way. I do not like to lecture. I don't like to listen to myself talk. And I don't know why they would want to listen to me talk. So the way that I teach is I try to engage people in dialogue, and I try to encourage people to think about the principles and the theory behind what's going on as opposed to just memorizing formulas. And so I decided that rather than listen to any of the advice I'd been given, I would go over there and I would do it my way and see how it worked. And after about an hour, the first day, the whole demeanor of the class changed. They very quickly picked up on the fact that I wasn't going to stand there and lecture the whole time. And I cold called people and I asked everybody questions. And I pointed out individuals and put them on the spot. And from that point on, the entire culture of the room became extremely collegial. And all of the students came to class every day fully engaged. They constantly were asking if we could organize events outside of the classroom. They got to know each other. They became friends. And every day was a dialogue. And so my basic takeaway was that the Chinese students are really no different than the American students. I feel like the teaching methods maybe that they are used to might be different, but when taught with the same approaches, they respond in the same ways. And so I really, you know, to answer your question, I didn't see any real difference between my Chinese students and my American students, with one possible exception, and I'll get in trouble for a sexist comment here, but the women students in China were really, really good. My best students were all female students.
And Yen Qing and I are not upset about your question. I'm smiling. The sisters are smiling. Well, great. I think you sort of answered my next question, and that was, what can China learn from Western teaching? And I had a similar experience when I was teaching at Fudan. My students came to me and said, you changed our way of thinking, because I taught the Socratic method, where I had my students get into groups and they have to present their recommendations. And I actually chose Lenovo versus the North Carolina company as the cases that I taught. And yeah, so they had also not experienced that way, the Western way of teaching. So is there anything else, maybe if you were to help faculty in China, maybe change or modify or augment the way they teach, what advice might you have?
Well, I would just say to connect with the students. There were the faculty at the university. I was teaching in a summer school, so all the students were Chinese who were going to U.S. colleges, and they were home in Beijing for the summer, and they were picking up summer school credits for their American universities. So all of the faculty were from other U.S. universities, Yale, Wisconsin, UCLA, places like that. And most of the American faculty complained the whole time that their Chinese students wouldn't talk in class. And it wasn't the students, it was them. they weren't engaging the students.
You chose not to treat them differently?
I chose to treat them exactly the way I treated my students in the U.S., and they responded exactly the way my U.S. students did.
So one thing I was told, and since you're a white guy, they saw me as a bridge, that I was schooled in the United States, but my parents are from China. So I'm wondering, so the people you spoke to, were they also white people, or were they?
Well, there was one Asian professor, she was from Yale, and one of her students really didn't like her, and so she said, you must be Japanese.
I'm just curious, because I'm a brain logic, so I'm just wondering, because you're not Chinese, I'm wondering if the students were open to you.
Well, I don't know, because most all the other faculty were white.
Okay, so you're just special. Okay.
No,
it's just that you didn't treat them special, you didn't treat them as special.
Exactly. Okay, kind of like what Paul was saying, is be yourself,
yeah.
And they responded in kind.
I'm not trying to promote JE China. We have 1 million kids in China every year, and the fourth grader, again, echo Michael's point, all the young ladies, they're champions. And secondly, they responded exactly as the kids here. So it's really the teacher's attitude and demeanor and how the professor, your attitude come across as a professor, as a teacher, I think, is to bring the best and potential out of the kids. So again, it's really, you know, Michael is Michael. He's a very inspiring person. So.
Great. Thank you, Michael. So my next question I'd like to direct to Yen Qing. And when I interviewed you, Paul, you reminded me that in the Chinese culture, and this may be more, this is one question I want to ask you, it may be changing. So I know that you were saying that the Chinese culture, the PhDs are like at the top of the totem pole. My dad was a professor, PhD, so I know that that is very high on the totem pole in China. So can you speak to how that might or might not be changing as far as the ranking of PhDs? And you also shared that like the business people were kind of very low on the totem pole. So I know when I decided to go to business school, when I told my parents, I kind of didn't get much kudos when I told them that I got to Harvard. Maybe that was a little bit okay because that was kind of a known school in China, but it wasn't like business school. So maybe if you could share a little bit.
Sure. Everybody in China knows Harvard, for sure, and MIT. So you don't have to explain.
But I wasn't an engineer, so that was like...
Whoa. That's okay. As long as you tell them you're Harvard or MIT, they will listen, no matter what degree you have from. And the second I have to say, maybe comment on the Chinese culture is for 2,000 plus years is rooted in the elite system. So it's around the education. That's the only way the poor kid in the countryside can get away and rise through the ranks to the top and together receive whatever kind of recognition by the emperor. So that was thousands of years ago, but that system has so much rooted in the history of the culture itself, it stays. So people, or Chinese, really respect education. Educated people. So that's the reason they look up to maybe PhD, you have an advanced degree. You know, it's a little bit of watering down in a lot of sense because in the last, because with the reform, everything I have to say, people, not every PhD is created equal. We all know that here, right? So, but when people love to, especially if they want, maybe perhaps they want to put in front of their name with a doctor, not always the case, but most of them are very smart. So regardless, I think back to your question, like how the ranking stays, I don't think there is a ranking per se as PhD next to MBA, because
I know it's not published, this was more metaphorical, the ranking, yes.
But the elite system in China stays. It's still, people recognize, like you go to that school, even from middle school, many people you would know, or high school, what kind of high school you got a better ranking, so you can get to the best universities. Now they rank the universities, perhaps, but what kind of jobs they have, how many people they get out to outside China to pursue an advanced degree. So they trust all kinds of rankings.
So probably the number of PhDs is probably steadier growing along the population as far as the study of the PhDs.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you. Paul, were you going to?
I think it would be beneficial to all of us to have a quick review of the Chinese history. And for thousands of years, China was ruled by emperors. In 1911, the last emperor was overthrown. So for 30 years from 1911, and China was marred by war, first by warlords, then Japanese invasion for 8 years, then civil war for 4 years. So from 1911 to 1949, it was a period of war. Then from 1949 to 1979, ladies and gentlemen, it was ruled by Chairman Mao Zedong's policy. Then from 1979 to 2009, only, what, how many years? 4 years ago, 5 years ago? 2014 minus 2009, how many years? 5 years. Ladies and gentlemen, 1979 to 2009, my hair is still the same way. China become the second largest economy for 30 years. So what would you say 2009 to 2039, what China will be? So coming down to the elites, the Chinese has the old saying, in the book One finds what? Gold. The second thing you find what? Come on. What? You find a pretty girl. Am I right? And what else do you find? Right? The Chinese truly believe that education is the shortest path to what? To success. And that is ingrained in us. Why is that? I don't want to insult people. I can tell you, my grandfather is just merely a junior high school grad, but he was the ruler of a county. Now, most of the people I asked, for those people who attended Beijing University, if your grandfather does not read, can you stand up? Many of them stand up. Now, we're talking about the past 10 years. So we have to understand China. It has such a big population. The elite might be a junior high school in my grandfather's time. Today, somehow, that effect is compounding. Somehow we worship people from Harvard University. I'm a little bit upset about that. I didn't graduate from Harvard University. I didn't graduate from made in Taiwan, no, MIT. That's meant to be a joke, so. That's American civilization, so. So, I graduated from Berkeley Polytech. The only reason I joined Bell Laboratory, because they pay me full-time salary, I can have 2 days and go to graduate school to get my PhD. Do you know what I did in that 2 days? I was chasing girls in that 2 days.
You didn't tell me that in an interview.
Because my wife was standing there. So I want to encourage the young Chinese students, the young professionals, come over here, have fun. And that old saying, in the book there is money and there is a pretty girl. Man, he doesn't work. It didn't work for me, I can tell you that. So if we can do something, one is that we do not carry on this stereotype. That somehow, you being a Chinese, you have to graduate from Beijing University to have a future. God forbid that. And I can tell you a real news. Now, I work with a lot of chairman CEO in China. And I can tell you today, people from Beijing University, Tsinghua University, it is so difficult to teach them how they behave in the company because they believe they know it all. So I want to encourage, I'm not discriminating against Harvard, MIT. And I want to promote UNC Chapel Hill, maybe. What I want to encourage you is that forget about those ideas. You got to be you. You got to believe in yourself. You got to believe that you can make the difference and you can do it. That's all I really want to say.
Thank you, Paul.
I talked to my fourth grader like that. So.
Okay, great. So moving on to some questions related to the economy and government. And this question's for Michael, especially given your background in investment banking and M&A advisory. So you've now been to China. You've probably seen how different China is than the U.S. So my question is, what is a major challenge to Chinese companies in gaining access to the world's capital markets?
I think the biggest challenge that the Chinese companies have is a very fundamental challenge, and I don't think it's very well understood in China. And that is that the global capital markets function on the basis of integrity and transparency. And so in order for companies to be able to raise money globally, they need to be able to produce financial information that people believe is true and that is documentable. And recently the Chinese government prohibited foreign ownership of CPA firms in China. And more recently, within the last few weeks, the Securities and Exchange Commission, which is the regulator in the United States that is charged with monitoring the integrity of the financial markets and the integrity of financial information has asked some Chinese auditors for information, and they've refused to provide that information. And I think this is going to be a major issue. This is not an issue that you're reading about on the front pages of newspapers. It's not an issue that economists talk about because economists don't really understand it all that well. But the capital markets, like I said, really require trust and faith in the financial statements. And so I think there's going to be a real awakening because the Securities and Exchange Commission is not going to allow Chinese companies to raise capital in America if they aren't transparent in their financial information. So I think it's going to be watch it unfold. It's not something you guys read about in the sports page of the New York Times, but it's gaining a lot of attention in the Wall Street Journal.
So a follow-on question regarding the Chinese economy, which, as we've seen, has had dips and swings, some incredible growth as well as dips in the last many years. So what is the present government doing to make the growth of the Chinese economy sustainable?
Wow. If you believe that a market economy is more sustainable, then I would say they're doing just about everything they can to make it sustainable. I read the China Daily cover to cover every day while I was there for 2 months. And what surprised me about what I was reading is that the leaders of the way I envisioned it based on reading the Western media was that the Chinese people really wanted a market economy and the political leaders were holding them back. And when I got over there and I read China Daily every day, it was the exact opposite. The leaders of the country were promoting free markets. They were promoting deregulation. They were pushing people in businesses to become more market-oriented. And it was the local governments and a lot of the business people that were resistant to change. And so I found that very, very surprising. But if you read the quotes in China Daily of the leaders of China, and you read the quotes of our leaders in Chapel Hill, you'd have a hard time figuring out who are the capitalists.
Thank you, Michael. So my next question is for Paul, and I'm interested to see what your thoughts are in Chinese companies interested in M&A activity here in the United States, and what implications might there be for here in North Carolina?
I want to piggyback
what
Michael said. For the Chinese company to raise capital here, likewise, when the Chinese come here to do M&A, and probably I can contribute 2 points. I believe that the Chinese company not only need to be transparent and everything is accounted for. Therefore, when they come up here to do M&A, and they really need to understand the methodology and the tools that they have to understand. Because methodology give you a rigorous way to follow step by step to ensure quality of your work. So I think that process needs to be well understood and well followed. And my daughter graduated from Acton MBA in University of Pennsylvania. Young lady, very intelligent, available, and very pretty too. So she was hired for 2 months, and she said it is the first time and a Chinese company in China is taking an American public owned company in Chapter 11 and taking it out of the bankruptcy. And so she was on the selling side. And her experience is the Chinese company and basically do not understand the process, do not understand the engagement and renegotiate over and over. And
they would, at the end, they would ask for a concession of $250,000 for $30 million dollar deal. That is just not the type of a civilization we will agree. It's not very gentleman or ladylike. At the last second, you negotiate a penny. So I think those are the areas, in my opinion, that the Chinese company need to understand the American, if you come here, how we act, how we negotiate, and how we do business. So I will hope that the people from bank company, people from PwC can probably help the Chinese side to understand the process, to understand the civilization in negotiation. You can play hard, but at the end, we have to become friends. So I think, again, it's in that area, I think Chinese can learn. Because M&A is such a new idea to us. I mean, can you imagine? It was all by us all along the way. All of a sudden, we have to come across to buy something. Very different process, very different experience. But I think we can learn. So I would say those are the areas that the Chinese company need to learn. They're very intelligent. They can read the number. They can do all these things. But it is how you conduct yourself at a critical moment that will determine whether the deal will go down with both parties happy about it. And at the end of the day, it is the reputation of the Chinese company eventually has to be understood. And if we can learn that, then the trustworthiness of the Chinese company coming over here will be the benchmark of how successful they will be in this country. It is trustworthiness. Without trustworthiness, without trust, there will be no business at all. So in my opinion, those are the values need to be promoted.
Okay, thank you, Paul. The next question comes from the audience. So, Yan-Chan, like if you could start the answer to this question. What do you see as the aspirations for the rising middle class in China? What does the man on the street in China want?
Aspiration of the middle class in Chinese? I would think the middle class of Chinese, the middle class in China, have two things probably as a whole. And first, they want to see a stronger China in general, just because of what Paul was talking about in the history of China over the last 100 years, just basically humiliation after humiliation. So for them, as they grow and they get richer themselves, they want to see a better China, stronger China can stand up for itself. The second one, I think just like everybody else, the middle class, they want to see themselves and their children to have a better life, period. So all they care, most of them do not care about politics, who is in power, whichever government, all they care they can put food on the table and to have a better life for themselves and for their children. So I think that's the aspiration for them in general.
Okay, great. Thank you. So, Michael, you started touching a little bit about how women in China, and how they're such great students, the females, and Yan-Chan were smiling. So, I read some of your commentary that was published when you returned from your teaching, and you mentioned that the lack of gender discrimination, the lack of cultural bias toward women, and then you also mentioned the lack of religious tension. Could you comment a little bit more on these, and are they advantages for Chinese businesses, and maybe what could we learn from that?
Yeah, I think that it's a huge advantage for China. The amount of energy in most countries that is diverted because of religious tension, particularly in developing countries, is amazing. And that is not a distraction. That there did not seem to be tension over these issues on a daily basis in China. And the same thing with the role of women versus men in the business world and economy. There seems to be, and I know that if you look very high up in the government, you don't see a lot of women. And if you look very high up in a number of corporations, you don't see a lot of women, just like in the United States. But in sort of the middle levels and in the teaching professions and in the day-to-day life, it seemed to me like there was very little gender discrimination. And so I think both of those are real advantages. If you compare China to countries like India, Brazil, Russia, and others, you see a lot more diversion of energy for issues like that.
So how did your stay in China differ from your expectations? And what perhaps was the most surprising?
Well, fortunately, Yinqing and you both had lunch with me and told me everything I should expect in China. So.
There are no surprises.
So,
we prepared him well.
I was very well prepared. I talked to a lot of people before I went, and I read a fair amount before I went. I guess the two things that surprised me most were related to the amount of Western influence. I've been to a lot of international cities all over the globe, and Beijing, where I taught, I considered to be an international city until I got there. And I would go to Tiananmen Square, I would go to the Great Wall, I would go to the Forbidden City. I wouldn't see any Westerners. Get on the subway, no Westerners. And I understood that Chinese children are educated in English, but I couldn't find any evidence of that. I didn't find anybody. Even I was staying in a really high-end Marriott hotel, and almost nobody in the hotel spoke English. So it was much less of an international city than I would have ever expected. That said, if you drive around, you wouldn't know that, because everywhere you look, there's Western stores. So you see all these high-end European and American, it's like Fifth Avenue on every street corner almost. There's all sorts of Western commerce over there, and there's, it seems like every other car is an Audi. And so it was just very different being there and feeling the look was very Western in the sort of real estate, but from a composition of the population, it was probably the least diverse city I've ever been.
Interesting. Thank you for sharing that. Do you have
comments? Culture is local, civilization is global. So culture, I mean, that's his experience, but when you land in Beijing and the civilization, Gucci and Bentley and Louis Vuitton. They don't say Louis Vuitton, they say LV. So that's just another evidence of that. Shanghai is probably worse.
Okay, great, thank you. So my last set of questions before we turn to the audience is around community service. And I was fascinated when I interviewed you and some of your commentary on philanthropy in China as a comparison to the United States. And Michael, you and I, of course, we were born here, in both in the South. Here, you know, I was in Atlanta, and we're involved a great deal with community. In fact, one of the boards that we serve on representatives here tonight. So I'm very fascinated, Paul, if you could share a little bit of your story about how you decided to start Junior Achievement China. And maybe you can talk a little bit also about your foundation and what impact you hope to achieve. And then, Yinqing, I'd like for you to speak a little bit about NCCBA, which you obviously been instrumental in starting.
Well, Junior Achievement. I love China very much. It is my homeland. And ever since I was little, and my mother taught me about the little donkey in Beijing, and how she grew up. And so I was fascinated by the courtyard and by her life.
and she talked about the good food in Beijing, and my mouth waters, and so I have this fantasy about China, and so after my Korean tour in 1983, I landed in China, and I fell in love with China, and I no longer can come back to America and work for Bell Laboratories. I was groomed by Bell Laboratory to be someday be in China and be part of the leadership for Bell Lab. Eventually became Lucent Technology, and it bankrupted in my lifetime. Can you imagine that? Lucent bankrupt. And so I love my home country, and then I resigned from Bell Laboratory and started my company, and with the intent, how can I contribute to my home country? And I learned the American civilization, you can play hard, you can make a lot of money, and you kick the bucket, don't give money to your son. and do something with it. So the Chinese has an old saying, the wealth will never pass through three generations. So I learned from the American friends, and I learned what can I do. So I hired my staff, whose job is to find what is the best thing I can contribute to China. So he worked for me, he reads books and so on for 10 years. So I did research, what can I do for my country. So eventually I realized junior achievement is the best export from America. And I was invited to serve on the board for JA International, take JA program to worldwide. The junior achievement teaches young people about entrepreneurship. So I recognize that program will help the young people in China to have a common language with the rest of the world, young people, the language of economy. And everything centered around economy. And the Chinese kids in China, before JA, they believe, in the book you can find what? Gold. In the book you can find what? Handsome young man. But they don't teach them the common language of economy. So I decided to take JA to China. And it's been 20 years. It is the best enterprise I ever engaged. So it's really to give the young people in China to have a common language with the rest of the world, the language of economy. You know, how do you trade, you know, 大白兔汤? How many people love that, right? Oh, you love it, right? And for Chinese New Year, three nights ago, I had three American family with me. One family stayed in Beijing for 12 years, and two of the three daughters grew up in Beijing. Guess what they fight for? 大白兔汤. So that's how I get involved and to learn how to run a privately held family foundation. And how I apply the wealth that I created for the benefits of the young people in China, and hopefully that the kids here and the kids in China will engage with each other through summer programs. For my family foundation, we invest in Asian American so that Asian American can become the leaders of America. And it took me a long period struggle because my daughter says, Dad, are you going to focus on Chinese American? And I said, yeah, that's what I want to do, Chinese American. So my three children convinced me, Dad, your view, your worldview is so narrow, Chinese American. How about Korean? And I said, what about them? They said, do you care for them? And I said, well, I don't know. I said, how about Japanese American? I said, So it was a long struggle. Eventually I said, being America, and I should have a wider worldview. So I said, yes, it will be Asian American. So my foundation is called Leadership and Legacy Development for Asian American. So I see Asians with such a wonderful heritage, merits of Asian culture, and coming to America or being born in America like Grace and Yenqing, that you can learn the American culture, learn the American civilization, and merge into one new being. And we have to come and enrich the American culture, American civilization, and we should create wealth and give back to society. And I hope that Asians can be a major contributor to our community. And so make a lot of money, save a lot of money, don't give to your son, and give to the community. So that's really, I just learned, and I had a great time, and I hope I can inspire other people to join me. And I may want to be a sponsor for you guys. And I'd be like, I think that Noble
should
donate 100 grand in my opinion.
That's the other point. Well, good. That's a good segue to my question for Yenqing. Before we turn to the audience, Yenqing, if you could just maybe close the panel, my question about what your vision is for the nonprofit that you helped start. It sounds like Paul, he had some ideas, good ideas that I'm sure you would accept.
So more than 10 years ago, when Frank, here, our chairman, current chairman, and also Len Wu and myself. So we kind of started thought to establish a platform to today, so that which people can come together, really networking for the common kind of a learning to do business with China, and establish this platform, and through which really building a bridge that between China and the U.S. business community. So that's the reason how we formed the North Carolina Business Association. And 10 years later right now, and it's really developed into a platform truly, we hope, into the future that people here in North Carolina can really leverage as a platform for people to give back, like Frank and Len Wu and myself were thinking, and also we have so many other volunteers involved throughout the years, like Yun Ji, currently the president as well, spent so much time together. And so if you ask me a vision into the future, I don't have a vision, but really, and this platform is for the community, so I hope the community can leverage such a platform and really through that and encourage the business relationships so we can make money on both sides. Really, that's a win-win business relationship.
Okay, great. So I'm sure that you all have questions that you'd like to ask. Is there a floating mic? Or maybe we could mention a few.
Well, mine is difficult.
Maybe we need to share
tricky.
That one.
You have to push.
Hey, Kathy, do you want to ask the first question?
Thank you, Grace. So great. So thank you all the speakers here us with so great experience. My name is Kathy Kimball, and I represent the China Press, the local Chinese language newspaper. Before I ask the question, I would like first I tell Paul. You said your wife is not here today, but we will report today.
I will offer anything you want.
And also, I would like to share my perspective from I born in China and also have more than 10 years working experience in China and also living in the U.S. for more than 10 years. My perspective is that everybody talking about doing business, I think maybe it's much easier for American go to China to do business because China is so looking forward to all the American products. Like without doubt, they will believe your product much better. But for Chinese come to the U.S. to do business, talk like Paul said, it's a lot for cultural, you need to know what's the culture here, and plus the total system in China, and here is based upon the competition, your products, people like, then you succeed. But in China, a lot of regulations, government regulations, and the permissions, you get a permit, then you advance. You don't get a permit, you cannot sell some products. So that's just a little bit sharing. Then is my question, talking about do business, I think I have two categories. One is product, one is service. A lot of successful stories on product, like you sell, like Jian Qin said, sell product in China or produce product in China. These are a lot of successful stories. I would like to ask you, expert, to give us like one common reason why the success. They have a lot of reasons success or a lot of reasons maybe failure, but what's the common reason for their success? That's one question. The second question is that regarding products may be kind of straightforward, like you get the right product, you get a lower cost, and you apply the people like your product, but the service area maybe relates more cultural challenge. So regarding the service area, so what's the opportunities like for businessmen, either do business in China or either do business in the U.S. regarding this service area? I'd like to listen to expert talking.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You want me to tackle that?
Yeah.
I don't think it's as much a cultural issue as it is an experience in business issue. If you and this was something that was openly talked about frequently in China, if you look at the top 100 brands in the world, and we know how big the Chinese economy is, if you look at the top 100 brands in the world, how many of them are Chinese? And it's because China has built its economy on doing what other countries have done less expensively or better, as opposed to doing something different. In other words, innovation is the key in having a true market acceptance. And the Chinese economy has been more of a back, when you look at a company, it's more of the back end, it's more the production, as opposed to the marketing and the front end, and understanding the consumers and designing products and coming up with new ideas. And so I think I don't think that's cultural. I think that transcends any national boundary, that the consumers want products that are new and innovative and meet their needs. And that skill set is just beginning in China, in my opinion, from what I could see while I was there.
Why I say it's a culture, I heard from
why I'm saying that the Chinese come to U.S. is much more difficult because of cultural difference. I heard from a businessman, he's doing the posting business in the U.S. market, but from produce from China. He said it take him 10 years find right products that Americans like. For example, porcelain in China a lot, but they get a lot of exhibition here, then Americans don't buy it. But when they develop to a lamp, then it's so popular. So they sell good. So he told me that takes him 10 years to find the right product that the U.S. people like. So that's what I'm thinking. It's like a really culturalized.
I hate to interrupt you, but I want to piggyback what Michael said. Weight may be a culture issue because it's an easy answer. Oh, somebody look at me funny. Oh, I'm Chinese.
And I think that's an easy cover. I'll give you one example. One laboratory bankrupt, and I applaud it. How many of you know one laboratory? Don't you agree they ought to be bankrupt? Let me tell you why it should bankrupt. One laboratory started manufacturing a calculator. It was John, I forgot his name, he's my age now, John.
It's early Alzheimer's.
It's early Alzheimer's. Let's say, whatever his name, John Huntington, whatever. It was John something, a white guy.
We all look the same.
You all look the same, but the name is unique. And, I just had a snap eye. It was John, and he made my laboratory a huge success. In the early 80s, one laboratory dominated the word processor market. One laboratory dominated, and he will kill IBM typewriters. But John Cunningham, that's his name, and at that high peak of one laboratory, and when Dr. Wen replaced John Cunningham, and with his son Fred Wen, and Fred Wen is just a playboy in Boston, and he just went south. No, I'm not trying to badmouth about when, but it's something we can learn from it. Now, we're in the 21st century. We're in the global market. We should hire white guys like Michael to run the company. Don't you agree? There are plenty of talents in this country for the Chinese company. They should be confident to hire the local talents, create jobs. Many of you here who understand both Chinese culture and American culture. You are the future candidates for the Chinese company to come here and hire you. And to come into the business. We're in the 21st century, we're in the global market. I dominate the Japanese market 100%. I hired a Japanese president. I spent a lot of time learning how to eat sushi. I have to drink sake, and I have to crawl into a little space and eat $250 a meal. And I have to learn a lot of things. So I think the Chinese company can come here, hire somebody like Michael Jacobs. I mean, his salary is about $2 million. Okay, that's all right. If he doesn't make my company make $1 billion, he better be careful. So I would say Lenovo, all these companies, they should hire local talent, create a job, and become a local company. It is our mindset. Somehow I gotta be under control. We know how to do relationship. I don't see any difference between me and Michael. He just played golf better than me. And he gave me a stroke, he sucked me in, and I had to spend $400 for a dinner. And I'm waiting to do that. Because why? We build relationships. We become buddies. And also then he sucked me into on this panel. And I'm a very private man. And I say, all right, I'm in. So I would encourage you all to look at yourself differently and talk to the chairman CEO, who might be your father, and said, you come here, you hire the white boys. Man, they work better. They just say, they really don't know what they're talking about. You probably should hire a white lady to manage them all. So I would say we're in the 21st century. We got to build a relationship with the NC state government. We have a Republican governor now. Can you imagine that? Some of you local understand North Carolina politics. But we can have a Republican governor. Can you imagine that? Right? So people can change, people can learn. But this is America, and we have to come here and to be part of America, part of American experience. So don't try to be humble. I mean, come on, Chinese are not, never be humble. Do you agree? Are Chinese humble? Do you really believe in that? Is it false humility or true what?
in China. So this is a free, this is a country that you can be yourself. So come over here, be part of America, and be a local company, hire the talents here, and truly commit you to America. And in that way, then there's an equity relationship. Then people feel good to do business with us. And we as Chinese, because Chinese New Year, then our children, our future generation, is truly part of America. America is a melting pot. So I will answer your question is, when you write a different worldview, wear a different pair of lens, help the Chinese community to understand America. In culture, there's no right and wrong, and we can learn from each other. I hope I can convey my heart and my experience to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul. Other questions, huh? Here.
Hi, my name is Katrina Wirtz. I'm a student at UNC, and I'm working on founding a business. So my question is for all of you, a bit building off of what all you just talked about, when you are founding a company that's multinational, so you're going to be dealing with other cultures and other civilizations, and you may not understand them completely, when you want to hire local talent, how do you determine if your vision aligns? And when you're figuring out if your vision's aligned, how do you, as in leadership, perhaps take a step back and not try to control everything while still maintaining that your vision does not get changed?
Well, that's a brilliant question.
Yeah,
that's
brilliant,
a very, very,
very
good question.
Brilliant question. Number one, the Chinese has always talk about two words. And we Americans, we just don't talk about that word. Wanxi. Networking. So when you go to Japan, or when you go to England, or when you go to China, you will, number one, use your network. And I hope that you have a spec for the person that you're looking for. Just like you want to find a pretty girl, I mean, I spell it out exactly what she looks like. If she's asked me to be a PhD, guaranteed, fire her on the spot. So, I don't know how to play tennis. So you have a spec, and use your network, and use credit reference. And thirdly, is spend time with him or her. Truly understand what he or she is like. So in other words, spend time with the person and check him out or check her out. And then trust but verify and let him or her perform and over a period of time. And then you have to let it go. And it's like throw a dice, and if it doesn't work, fire her or fire him on the spot. But you have the whole issue, the whole decision reflects you and not on the other side. So the first time you got cheated, and shame on him or her. But the second time, is that how you say it? First time, shame on me. And the second time, shame on me. So you hire the person exactly how you hire over here. No difference. At least that's my experience.
Thank you so much. Okay. Next question here.
Hi. My name is Daniel Yang. I'm a second year MBA student at Wake Forest. It's such a great pleasure to be here tonight. And I've been in the United States for less than 2 years, and before I came down here, I worked for French television back in Beijing as a news producer. When I first got here, I noticed I had an interesting observation that a lot of my classmates, neighbors, and even some of the professors in my school, they still associate China with communism. The first time I moved into my apartment, my neighbor referred to me as, hey, I got a communist neighbor. That sort of thing. He's a nice guy. He's a nice guy. He's a really nice guy. He's the kind of person who can call everybody with the most offensive term, and nobody will associate it with the, you know, racially biased. But he's a nice guy. But yeah, my question is, what do you think is the role of ideology is playing in the business, especially the Sino-U.S. business? Or is that still a role playing in people doing business? By ideology, I mean exactly communism and capitalism. And that's my question. Thanks.
I'll take a stab at that. I think that my observation is that right now, China is both communist and capitalist. And it's going to be an interesting experiment in the evolution of a nation to see how long they can maintain a communist government and a capitalist economy. But if you look at just, you know, the fact that the internet was down for 8 hours, why was it down for 8 hours? It's still a communist country in many respects. But at the same time, the economy is very capitalist. I wasn't kidding. It's more capitalist than Chapel Hill. There is a lot of emphasis on opening up markets, on building brands, on building the economy, on bringing people into the cities, on developing a service economy, developing intellectual property. There's far more enforcement of intellectual property right violations than there used to be. And so in every respect that I could see, China is very rapidly developing a capitalist economy. But from a government standpoint, it's not a democratic capitalism.
Still, your microphone.
So, growing up in a communist country, I grew up there and came here. So, I have to say, over the last 20 years, the Chinese government has really executed strategy and focusing on economy. It's called the economy is freedom. So, as long as they give people the freedom to pursue capitalism without the fear or the possibility of overthrowing the government. So like all the government, I guess it's called economic freedom in a way, and really they executed well. Now for most of the Chinese or any other country, 99% of the Chinese, they don't care who is in charge. They want to live in a better life. I think Chinese government understands it very, very well. And they will pursue economic freedom policy and for the foreseeable future, because there is no point of return anymore. Because once the people experience it, they want to have a better life for themselves, for their children. So as a government itself, I must say, the Chinese government, whether you call it Communist Party government or Communist government or capitalist government, in a lot of sense, it's not a true communist anymore. It will continue to pursue that economic freedom policy and to make sure people, or majority of them, will not be unemployed staying on the street, because that's very dangerous. When you have so much population without job, they're chatting around, unionized or whatever, get grouped together, that's where the unstable the government would be, right? Because they will find an overthrow, do whatever they need to do. So as the government itself will continue to pursue that policy without any doubt in my mind. But of course, facing a lot of challenges, Michael and Paul are talking about how they can execute it in a way that's a meaningful way without really getting people so out of the sort of order and create chaos.
I talk too much, so since I talk too much, I might as well just say.
Next.
So I think we might take
one more question, because we're at the end of our time. 8:30. So, Wendy, would you like to end our discussion with the last question?
Hi, I'm Wendy Curran. I'm with Duke University, helping to develop DKU, the Kunshan University there. So I wanted to talk about, or have you guys talk about, a topic that Michael briefly touched on, which is innovation. So I have a two-part question. What observations do you have about China valuing innovation and acting upon those values? Where is that going? And sort of part of that is, on the education front, I think probably the most important thing that's happening is junior achievement. Is that you're getting young kids excited about innovation and they'll pursue it. But what about people who are already, you know, at the college level or working in society? I mean, are there other leverage points to help teach innovation and generate innovative thinking and new products and all that?
Thank you.
I talk too much.
I think the best thing that could be done for innovation in China is junior achieve.
I think innovation is not overnight thing, and so I think we should give a certain expectation. And I started junior achievement 20 years ago. For the first 12 years, I have only 1,000 kids. So the Chinese has an old saying, Michael, this is a Chinese old saying. When you grow bamboo and you plant the seed and it comes up, and you water and you did everything, for 7 years, it's about this tall, but on the seventh year, boom, it shoots up. So I think innovation requires your investment and my investment. And the bottom line, in my perspective, you have to start young, and you cannot to transform an old guy like me. And I don't care. Whatever you tell Alice, I ain't going to change. So it's difficult to change as you become, you know, Michael is about 10 years younger than me, and it's difficult to change. So I think you will see innovation down the road. So my prediction is what happened in Korea eventually will happen in China. The Korean government intentionally and spend so much money and send so many students to Rhode Island School of Design. If you go to RISTIC, it's all Koreans. They're all executive from Samsung. So eventually, in my opinion, the Chinese government, the state-owned enterprise, will realize that they're going to help junior achievement students and to come here to study. And off the record, many multinational company will only interview the students from the Chinese college who have been through JE program. I'm not bragging about it. It's because when we invest in the young people and they will come out, it is inborn in them. So I'm a firm believer that you and I are from the same parents, and the human being is the same. Just like Michael said, he doesn't see the student differently. It's how we look at the universe. So I hope that Duke University will be successful. I think I mentioned before.
Yeah, I think it was somewhat of a rhetorical question. I think you know the answer is education. And how do you teach an accountant to sell? I mean, it's the same thing. It's, you know, with if you have people that are trained to be a certain way and they're wired a certain way, they're going to behave a certain way, and the only way to change those behaviors is through education. So that's the answer. Whether it's Duke University going to China or whether it's Chinese students coming to the U.S. and going back after they're educated here, it's got to be education that teaches them to think a different way.
Last question?
actually, that was the last question, I think. Just we can, you can maybe ask this afterwards. Just want to respect everyone's time, so we're a few minutes after.
Yes, and there is a UNC game on right now. No, against Maryland.
So anyway, I want to close the event, but I like really thank you for all the panelists for lovely discussion, meaningful conversation, and really inspiring story. Actually, I like the poem. Maybe I should know you more. And anyway,
I just donate some money to that.
Oh yeah, I really.
I'm a salesman.
So I really appreciate you will become a sponsor for NCCBA. Yeah.
You give a dollar, I give a dollar.
Oh yeah, yeah, okay, we do that. Yeah. Anyway, I'd like to close because I know maybe a lot of questions, but I'd like to leave some time after this and you have some individual interaction with the panelists. But here, I, on behalf of NCCBA, I will give a panelist a gift. I thank you very much and give them big applause. Okay, thank you very much. Let's close and give you a big applause again.
Thank you.